So I'd like to go straight back into the text. So we're now on page 14 in the middle, where it says conclusion. So remember, in this text, the actual explanation, we had the three parts, the preliminaries, the foundation practices, the actual practice of Mahamudra, which we could see that could be practiced at two levels, sutra and tantra. And in this text, a very brief tantra level explanation came first, just to let us know what it's going to be like later. And then we have been following the sutra explanation, because that's the level we need to start at. And in there, of course, we have the two main practices of shamatha vipassana. In the shamatha section, we looked at how to observe the mind as the object for shamatha practice, and also the resting and awareness practice. And then on that basis, we looked at the vipassana practice. And in the vipassana practice, of course, the presentation was divided into two sections. The first section was he gave some examples of vipassana explanations in the various Mahamudra lineages, how to introduce the nature of the mind to the disciples. And then in the second section, which we've just now completing, he presented the essence of all of those instructions. What is the nature of the mind that is trying to be introduced to the disciple there? And there, of course, we've been looking at this idea of emptiness. So we've gone through a quite extensive presentation of how to establish the view of emptiness, and then how to meditate on that by first focusing on me, the person, and investigating in that whether the me is the same or different than the body and the mind. And then also briefly how to then continue to practice this emptiness in daily life. And there's going to be some more explanation coming up shortly about that. And then how, on the basis of some experience of emptiness of me, the person, we can then shift our attention to the body, the mind, and other phenomena to come to realize emptiness. And then we had a look at the end of that section in terms of a way of looking at the mind to come to realize there's no inherently existent mind. The mind is also merely labeled on the basis, a continuum of many moments of mind. And at the last point there, we had a look at a measure that our emptiness practice is going in the right direction, and that is to, when we get to the point whereby our realization of emptiness is reinforcing or supporting our understanding that this everything is merely labeled. And then if we see the world of dependent arisings, that would reinforce our belief, or not belief, our realization that things are empty of independent existence. To really understand that emptiness and dependent arising are two sides of a coin, that's really a measure that our emptiness practice is going very well when we reach that point. And now we're coming to what's called the conclusion. And in the conclusion here, we have these two parts. The conclusion to the actual meditation, the actual practice, where we do our dedication, and then following that, what to do in post-meditation, outside of meditation. So here in the conclusion, the first part is to dedicate whatever virtue that has arisen from having meditated on Mahamudra, together with your ocean-like collection of virtue of the three times, towards unsurpassable great enlightenment. So remember, at the beginning of the meditation, the Mahamudra practice, of course, is in the Mahayana tradition. So we saw at the very beginning, in the preparation stage of the meditation, to go for refuge and generate bodhicitta, because bodhicitta is the entry point and central pillar for this Mahayana and, of course, the Mahamudra practice. So we try to set that motivation at the beginning of the practice of the meditation, and at the end, then we dedicate that meditation towards that goal, the goal of enlightenment. And now comes an explanation of, again, what to do outside of meditation, in post-meditation.
Or sometimes it's called subsequent attainment. We see that in the first line. It says, having familiarized yourself in this way in meditative equipoise, then during subsequent attainment. So this word subsequent attainment, it means to what to do subsequent to attaining some sort of experience in meditation. That's what it means. So it's really talking about the post-meditative state. So what to do? Remember, illusory-like emptiness. So here it says, investigate in detail the way in which appearances that dawn as the objects of the six consciousness are appearing. So remember, the six consciousnesses are the five sense consciousness and the mental consciousness. So we are to investigate in detail and see in what way are things appearing. And what we're going to see is that they appear to be independently, inherently existent. And then it says, if we do that, and then based on our emptiness practice, we will realize these appearances are deceiving us and that things are not existing as they appear. And it says, therefore, the way in which they exist as dreamlike dependent arising. So dreamlike, again, is like an illusion. A dream is something that does not exist in the way it appears. So then the way in which they exist as dreamlike dependent arisings will then dawn nakedly and resplendently. Now in this practice of emptiness, topic of emptiness, it's not so easy to understand emptiness. Of course we can mouth the words very easy. We can easily say everything's empty of inherent existence, but do we really appreciate what that really means? And so then here, often we have many analogies that are given to help us get some idea about what emptiness really means. One analogy that I like and I find very useful is the analogy of a dream. Now, of course, when we're dreaming, there appears to be an independent dream world there. There appears to be an independent dream me here. And then, of course, if we see something pleasant or unpleasant in the dream, we often react with attachment, aversion, fear, and so forth. But if we suddenly become lucid in the dream, meaning we realize the dream is a dream in the dream, lucid dreaming, then there will still appear to be an independent dream world there. There'll still appear to be an independent dream me here. But because we're lucid now, we will realize directly that these appearances are deceiving us. And then it becomes very difficult to react to appearances in the dream. It becomes more difficult to react with attachment to pleasant things and aversion to unpleasant things. Because we'll realize this is a product of our mind. And we'll enjoy the dream a lot more. Likewise, this view is saying things are like a dream. Because now, in our waking world, we are asleep with ignorance. There appears to be an independent me here. There appears to be an independent world out there. And we believe those appearances, which means when we have pleasant and unpleasant things appearing to us, we tend to react with attachment, aversion, big mess. But if we become lucid in the waking state by realizing emptiness, there will still appear to be an independent me here. There'll still appear to be an independent world out there. But because we're lucid now, because we've realized emptiness, we will directly realize these appearances are deceiving us, which means it'll become much more difficult to ever develop attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and we would enjoy the waking world a hell of a lot more. So, personally, I find the analogy of a dream can be very helpful, and often in this context, we see to see things like a dream. But there are many other analogies, to see them like an illusion, an echo, a reflection on the moon in the water. There are many analogies given in this context, but I particularly like the dream because with the dream analogy, lucid dreaming is something we can actually develop. And often when people first develop lucid dreaming, they're quite amazed at how vivid and real a reality their mind can produce. And also, of course, if we can develop lucid dreaming, then at higher levels of practice, we can actually do emptiness practice in a lucid dream. And then we can do all sorts of cool things. So you'll find that in the higher levels of practice, particularly in the area of Tantra, there's what's called dream yoga and sleep yoga, where we're doing those sorts of practices in a lucid dream state. If anyone's interested in lucid dreaming, Alan Wallace does a lot of work with lucid dreaming, dream yoga, and he's written a book recently called Dreaming Yourself Awake. So if you're interested, you might like to have a read of that. Okay, where was I? Yeah, so through that, your ascertainment of the ultimate nature of phenomena, of course, emptiness, will increase. So as I said before, in our daily life practice, through our understanding and experience of emptiness meditation, if we can come to realize that these appearances are deceiving us, we can see them as dreamlike, that they do not exist in the way they appear. And whenever we can do that, that's going to reinforce our emptiness practice. And that's highlighted here when he's quoting Maitripa, again, great Indian master, current with Naropa, about 10th century. Recognizing whatever dawns is the essential point of the view. So the essential point of the view of reality is in daily life to recognize that whatever is appearing to us is not existing as it appears, that it's merely imputed by conception and it only exists within the conceptual framework. That's the essential point here in daily life. So he says, in brief, do not grasp to any of those things which appear to you, even your own mind. So whatever appears to us, not to grasp onto it as existing as it appears, to not grasp onto it as existing inherently, independently. Constantly maintain your practice by alternating the space-like meditative equipoise of ascertaining the way in which they exist with the subsequent attainment of the undeniable dawning of dependently related agents and actions. So what it's saying is here, to sustain our emptiness practice, we're alternating between meditating and realizing emptiness with daily life, realizing that everything is a dependent arising. So this is the space-like emptiness, illusory-like emptiness. We alternate that. Through knowing how to maintain meditative equipoise and subsequent attainment in this way, it is necessary to familiarize yourself with the meditative equipoise of applying the single ultimate nature to all phenomena of samsara and nirvana. So the single ultimate nature, of course, is emptiness. So in meditation, by realizing, and we see that in the quote following, by we realize emptiness, and then thereby we realize emptiness of all phenomena, to familiarize yourself with that, and the subsequent attainment of applying the conventional nature of being illusory-like mere appearances to all phenomena. And so he's quoting here Aryadeva, the main disciple of Nagarjuna, and I think this is coming from his text, The 400 Verses on Emptiness, and he says, whoever is the seer of one thing, they are said to be the seer of all. Whatever is the emptiness of one, that is the emptiness of all. Meaning that when we come to realize emptiness based on one thing, the person or so forth, we realize the emptiness of all. It's not like we have to realize the emptiness of every individual single thing individually, otherwise we'd never achieve nirvana. So if we can realize the emptiness of one thing, we realize the emptiness of all. And then in daily life, to apply, to do this illusory-like emptiness practice, to see things as being like an illusion, like a dream. And then if we go over the page, it says, In that way, it is true that from the perspective of a correct meditative equipoise upon the ultimate nature, so from the perspective of a realization of emptiness, there is freedom from the elaborations of the extremes of existence and non-existence and so forth with respect to samsara and nirvana. Meaning, what that means is that in a direct realization of emptiness, none of these things are appearing. None of the things of samsara or nirvana appears, because the only thing appearing is emptiness. Then it says, however, after arising from that meditative equipoise, when you investigate, it is undeniable that there are dependently related agents and actions that exist as being merely imputed by name, and they naturally dawn as being like a dream, like a mirage, like a reflection of a moon in water, and like an illusion. So what he's saying there, of course, is that when we meditate and we're realizing emptiness, the only thing appearing is emptiness. No other phenomena appears at that time. But then, of course, when we come out of that meditation, then the whole world is appearing, and it's appearing as a dependent arising, that through our realization of emptiness, we will begin to see things as dreamlike, like an illusion, like all these things, because we will come to realize, because of our realization of emptiness, that things are not existing as they appear, and then we'll see them as dreamlike, dependent arising. We'll realize they're merely imputed. They only exist within the conceptual framework. And then to complete that point, there's one or two paragraphs here. It says, when emptiness is not obscured by appearances, and when appearances are not blocked by emptiness, at that time the excellent path of emptiness and dependent arising being equivalent becomes directly manifest. So as I said before, at the beginning stage, when we start to investigate emptiness, that seems to negate a functioning world, you know. Oh, doesn't matter because everything's empty, nothing really exists. So it seems like emptiness is negating this very world. And when we see the world, a functioning world, that seems to negate emptiness, because if it's functioning, it must be real, it must have its own unique nature, it must exist from its own side. So they seem to be contradictory, they seem to negate or block each other. But as we deepen our experience and realization of emptiness, we'll come to realize, as I said before, because things are empty, they can appear and they can function. And because things appear and function, they must be empty of independent nature. And that's what's being talked about here. When we get to that point, it'll be directly manifest that we understand that emptiness and dependent arising are two sides of a coin. That emptiness means dependent arising means emptiness. And here then he's quoting Tsongkhapa on this point. And Tsongkhapa says the following: as long as the assertions of appearances being undeceiving dependent arisings, meaning as long as we believe these to not be dreamlike and believe they are really existing independently, and emptiness are understood as two separate things, as long as they appear individually, you have still not understood the intent of the sage. The sage is the Buddha. When without alternating, as soon as the ascertaining consciousness merely sees dependent arisings as non-deceptive, means as soon as we see things to be dreamlike, and all modes of grasping to the object are destroyed. So as soon as we see things as dreamlike, realizing they do not exist as they appear, and we stop grasping onto them thereby as existing independently, then your investigation of the view is complete. Then we really have a clear understanding of emptiness. And it's also is quoting Nagarjuna on this point, who says, someone who through understanding the emptiness of phenomena sees cause and effect as tenable, meaning possible, This is more amazing than amazing. This is more marvelous than marvelous. So often in these sorts of texts, they say that actually someone who can, in a single mind, hold the idea of emptiness and at the same time hold the idea of functioning world, and that these are complementary and they're two sides of a coin, to actually have that is amazing. Because as a beginner, we think they're really contradictory. Either there is this real functioning world or there's no world. And so emptiness seems to negate the very existence of the world. So if we can get to that point, as Nagarjuna said, more amazing than amazing, more marvelous than marvelous. So let's now see how to get to that point. So to introduce that, we've got the next paragraph. It says, through sustaining Mahamudra, by riding on the horse of Shamatha in that way. So again, on the basis of Shamatha, we are doing our Vipassana practice. When a concentration imbued with the bliss of physical and mental pliancy is attained by the force of analysis focused on emptiness, then the heat level of the path of preparation is attained. So what that means is, and maybe to answer that, we can start to look at our Mahayana path chart. So this is the Mahayana path that we follow to enlightenment. And we can see that the Mahayana path here is divided into five stages called the path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, path of no more learning. And we see at the very beginning, number two down the bottom, which says uncontrived renunciation and bodhicitta. So remember, to the door of entry into the Mahayana path is when we cultivate bodhicitta. Here it says uncontrived, meaning when we have cultivated this aspiration for enlightenment for the welfare of others to the point where it's something that naturally and spontaneously arises, and it's the motivation for all of our activities, then we have entered the Mahayana path. And above that, we see ordinary bodhisattva, means now we've become a bodhisattva. So when we have this uncontrived bodhicitta, we enter the Mahayana path, we become bodhisattva. The first stage of the path we see here is called path of accumulation. So here the word accumulation is talking about the two accumulations, or sometimes called the two collections. And the two accumulations or collections are merit and wisdom. So merit here is basically the result of virtue. So merit, how to accumulate merit, simply means engage in virtuous activities. So here, of course, we're really talking about the compassion wing of practice, that we're trying to do virtuous actions based out of great compassion. And of course, the other thing we're trying to do is cultivate, accumulate wisdom, particularly here, this wisdom of emptiness. So on the path of accumulation, we are accumulating or doing a lot of compassionate activities. We're doing a lot of emptiness practice. Now, when we have entered the path of accumulation, we have achieved shamatha already. Now, as a beginner, now, of course, we go through the three stages. That first, we gain an intellectual understanding. So, as we saw earlier, we study, read, reflect, come to understand the concept of emptiness, dependent arising. Then we apply that in meditation. So on the basis of whatever stability and clarity we have, we investigate. And if our mind is somewhat stable and clear, we may come to taste or experience emptiness. And then that may still affect our mind a little bit after the meditation, and then it'll wear off. But if we want to get to the point of realization, then we need to cultivate shamatha. We need shamatha. Because in order to realize something, realization is a stable experience. To realize emptiness, we need a very stable and clear mind. We need the mind of shamatha. And we saw earlier, very briefly, that when we first come to realize emptiness, even with shamatha, it's still conceptual. That in this realization of emptiness, there's still a sense of me realizing emptiness. So we're realizing emptiness in terms of what's called generic image. We saw that earlier in the text. So we see emptiness through concept, but it's a valid one, but it's not direct yet. So this direct, conceptual realization of emptiness, of course, is very stable and very strong, and has a big impact in our life. So here, then, on the path of accumulation, we have achieved shamatha. So we're getting to this stage, but still, now when we meditate, shamatha vipassana, I think it mentioned earlier somewhere, we need to alternate. Meaning first, we develop some shamatha, the mind is stable and clear. And then on that basis, we investigate. And if we investigate too much, that'll disturb the mind. That's why it said we need to use a subtle awareness, like a small fish going through the water. Because if we're too much heavy analysis, our mind will get destabilized. And if that's the case, then we need to stop analysis, investigating, and go back and stabilize the mind, and then go back to the vipassana. So we need to alternate, because the vipassana initially will destabilize the mind a little bit, that investigation. And that's still the case on this path of accumulation, that we still need to alternate the shamatha with the vipassana. But then in the text we saw, I'll read it out again. When a concentration imbued with the bliss of physical and mental pliancy is attained by the force of analysis focused on emptiness, then the heat level of the path of preparation is attained. Which means when we're doing this on the path of accumulation, alternating, then at some point, instead of our vipassana disturbing the shamatha, it will enhance it, and then you'll have this bliss of mental and physical pliancy again, and then shamatha and vipassana will be unified. Remember in the shamatha chart, we said the last thing, it says the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. So that union happens. When that happens, we enter the path of preparation. So we see that number four. Union of calm abiding and special insight observing emptiness. Or in other words, union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. So that marks the path of preparation. When shamatha and vipassana become unified, we don't need to alternate anymore. But still on the path of preparation, it's still conceptual.
So we're realizing emptiness, and that conceptual realization of emptiness has a very strong impact on us. Meaning outside of meditation, due to the force of that realization, the mental afflictions are very much subdued. Meaning mental afflictions rarely come up. When they come up, they're very weak and they last a very short time. We haven't started to wipe them out yet, but the force of this conceptual realization is strong enough to subdue them, to keep them down. Then we see the path of preparation. On the path of preparation, the word preparation means we are preparing for our first direct realization of emptiness. So again, we continue to meditate on emptiness, realizing emptiness conceptually, me the meditator, realizing emptiness there. And then during that path, as we deepen our experience, this sense of me the meditator and emptiness the thing I'm realizing, the apparent duality there starts to collapse. And eventually it completely collapses. And then you have the first direct realization of emptiness, non-dualistic, non-conceptual. And that is marking the path of seeing. We see that number 7, initial direct realization of emptiness. When we realize emptiness directly, we enter the path of seeing. Seeing means seeing emptiness directly. And now, as it says here, we become an Arya. So remember, an Arya is anyone who's directly realized emptiness. Now, when we directly realize emptiness the first time, that one realization of emptiness is not enough to wipe out all of our mental afflictions and suffering. Only what's called the intellectually acquired levels of those. So what we need to do, of course, is we need to continue to realize emptiness directly, again and again and again and again. And slowly we begin wiping out more and more ignorance, mental afflictions. That's what happens on the path of meditation, the fourth stage. We see the path of meditation is divided into 9 sections. Those 9 sections plus the path of seeing together are called the 10 grounds or 10 bhumis in Sanskrit. The word meditation here is coming from the Sanskrit word bhavana. And bhavana means to familiarize or cultivate. So what we're doing on the path of meditation is we're familiarizing ourselves and cultivating again and again the direct realization of emptiness that we first had on the path of seeing. And then over the first 7 grounds, we're wiping out more ignorance, more mental afflictions. By the end of the 7th ground, now we have wiped out all mental afflictions, all ignorance. So we've gone beyond samsara, we've achieved nirvana, personal liberation. We've got rid of these afflictive obscurations, which we briefly mentioned, I think, yesterday. So we see that as number 9 underneath. 9, nirvana. But still, we haven't got rid of these subtle stains that we mentioned. These stains of ignorance which cause this mistaken appearance. So even an arhat who has achieved nirvana, to them, the world still appears to exist independent of them. But because they've realized emptiness, they realize these appearances are deceiving them. So they never accept these appearances. So they never cause any problems for the arhat. But still they have this mistaken dualistic appearance. How to get rid of that? We need to get rid of these subtle stains of ignorance in our mind. That's what we do over the last 3 grounds, 8, 9, 10. So here we are abandoning, getting rid of these cognitive obscurations, these subtle stains in our mind. And eventually at the end of the 10th ground, we sit down the last time, meditate on emptiness, realize emptiness directly, and then the very next moment, we're still realizing emptiness directly, the very next moment, the phenomenal world appears. We achieve enlightenment. So an enlightened being is directly realizing emptiness and seeing the phenomenal world at the same time. Only an enlightened being can do this.
What that really means is inconceivable for us. So then we achieve the fifth stage, the path of no more learning. We become enlightened. So that's very briefly the Mahayana path. Anyone have any questions about any of that? Which process? So, you see, on the path of seeing a meditation, in between each stage, we have those two dark markers. Mm-hmm. And it, down below it says uninterrupted path, liberated path. So this is meaning that we transition from one level to the next, always in meditation, when we do the transition. It means we sit down, we realize emptiness, we wipe out a little bit more ignorance, mental afflictions, and then we move to the next level. So that's all the way through there. So this, of course, is in our life. Now, how long does this whole stage five paths take? Varies. I mean, often they talk about this can take many lives. Now, in Tantra, we're gaining access to the very subtle mind. So, and that can accelerate the path. So in Tantra, we have also a description of the stages we go through to enlightenment, but it's not this. So this is the description of how to move using the coarse mind. This is the stages we go through. So in Tantra, they also have as like a tantric path model based on the very subtle mind and based on how we progress using that. But it's not looking like this. Yeah.
My question is, and so the right that when you get to the fourth path of accumulation, you already have shamatha.
Correct.
But it means to realize bodhicitta that you need shamatha too?
Yes. So remember, we need uncontrived bodhicitta. So it needs to be very stable bodhicitta. So so the general assertion is yes, to have uncontrived bodhicitta, we need a very stable mind. We need the mind of shamatha. There is some debate about this in some of the texts. Some scholars say you don't need shamatha to have uncontrived bodhicitta. But then they say, if we look at the shamatha chart, what these other scholars say is you don't need shamatha, but then they'll say you need this. You know, you need sort of 8 or 9. So you need to be up here to have uncontrived bodhicitta, because to have that, we need a very stable and clear mind. You won't be able to have this complete uncontrived bodhicitta without having a very stable mind. So more or less you have to have shamatha or something close to it to get to that level of bodhicitta. That's what's usually said in the text.
Is there a danger existing how many people?
Yes, I've got a little secret book on it, but I'm not going to show you. I'm going to keep it to myself. Again, as I mentioned, I think earlier, is that generally, as people progress on the spiritual path, one of the qualities they develop in huge amounts is humility. So often people who are really progressing in these stages wouldn't go around saying, I'm on the fourth ground, I'm an Arya Bodhisattva on the fourth ground at the moment, where are you? You don't really hear that so much. I mean, generally, if someone's boasting in public how high level they are, it's often a sign that they're quite deluded and, we need to be very cautious of them. It is said that particularly once we achieve path of seeing, we have a direct realization of emptiness. That starts to purify our mind. And it's said from that point, we can really see the minds of others. And then it said that if others are at our level or below, we know exactly where they are. And if someone's above our level, we don't know exactly, but we know that they're a higher level than us. So from that point on, it said that whatever level we're at, we'll directly know the minds of others who are at a similar level, or if they're lower level, exactly where they are. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, of course, if someone has realized emptiness, they will know the people who have directly. But also, of course, what can happen, because Lama Zopa, of course, was, you know, Lama Yeshe is one of his teachers. What can happen, of course, is that if a teacher who's realized emptiness or have some other high qualities sees that it's beneficial to tell or display these qualities to their student in private, if it's going to help them, they will do that. If they see that by telling them or displaying it, the student will get the wrong idea and the student will just worship them or something, they would never tell them. So it could also be the fact that Lama Yeshe displayed something to Lama Zopa or told him, although I don't know. So all of those are possible. Also, it could be that maybe Lama Zopa inferred, due to Lama Yeshe's way of speaking and behavior, that he had some realization of emptiness. So all of those are possible, all those variations.
Chet
Rinpoche's passed away now, but generally within the FPMT, the people who know him quite well and have some connection can sense that he's, you know, because I think he spent many years meditating. You know, he hid. I think he was in a house or something, and they made a secret room behind the kitchen. So to avoid the Chinese, and he stayed in there like 10 years or 20 years or something. 20.
I'm about 14, 20, yeah.
Yeah. So he was hiding in this little room, sealed off, and they were just passing him food, and no one else knew he was there.
And thereby also damaged his...
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Sitting too much, yeah.
But I was just
going to
ask also, like, for someone who can stay put down and realize...
In the death process.
Exactly. But that would be someone who's on the tantric path, or...?
Generally, if you're not in the tantric level of practice, you know, at the sutra level, there's no talk about clear light, this very subtle mind and that, and there are no real practices for trying to gain access to that. So someone who's not in the tantra probably has never received any instructions on how to be able to gain access to that through the death process. So probably unlikely that someone who's not in tantra would have that ability. So generally, that those sorts of instructions of how to prepare for death, to maintain awareness through the death process and sit in that tukdam state, is generally those instructions you only see within the context of tantra. So generally, it's people who practicing tantra that receive those instructions and practice in that way. I mean, it could be possible that someone who has developed that ability through some other means, but as far as I'm aware, that practices to do that, as far as I'm aware, only exist openly, at least within the tantra system.
Yeah, it just seems like to go all this way and be that high up without practicing something or having some notion about that.
Yeah. I mean, here, of course, this is the sutra-level Mahayana path. And so, of course, in those instructions and
tradition. There's no mention of very subtle mind and anything. So this is the way to achieve enlightenment. But then when you go talk to the Tantra people, they'd say, oh yes, that's very good, but unless you get to the very subtle mind, you're not actually going to get to enlightenment. I mean, they will, I think, often what I've read is that you can get very high on this model of a path using the coarse mind, but then the last little bit, to get rid of those last subtle stains, you need to access the very subtle mind. That's what the Tantra people say. But anyway, by the time you got there, going into Tantra practice, piece of cake, so it doesn't matter. But they would say that to remove the last little bit of subtle stain, you have to get in at that very subtle Tantra level to really get to enlightenment. That's what they assert.
I have one question from before. There was something about virtues of three times. Or
yeah, three times is past, present, future.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that means when we dedicate at the end of a meditation, we dedicate the virtue of having done the meditation, but then we dedicate all of the other virtue that we've done in the past and even the virtue that we're going to do in the future. So you dedicate all of that as well.
Yeah, that's a new notion to me, but it's kind of nice.
Yeah, no, I mean, that style of dedication you see fairly commonly.
I have never...
Really? Okay.
Or maybe I've heard it, but not...
Yeah, maybe it's not registered, yeah.
No.
Oh.
And then last, you somehow emphasized that on this path you concentrate only on emptiness, not meditation, but that is written like all this kind of perfection.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Right. So, the way of moving along here is always through an emptiness experience, but that doesn't mean that's all we're practicing. I mean, we're practicing the compassion wing of the practice, which includes all the other perfections. And so here we see on the first six grounds the actual six perfections. So, you know, we see that each one is associated with a particular ground. And what that means is that practice is perfected at that point. And there is some measure of what it means to perfect each of those six practices. And it's in the text, but I can't remember. But I think one of them that I do remember is ethics. That ethics is perfected on the second ground. And from memory, to perfect ethics is to have ethics to a point whereby you don't even have a non-virtuous thought in a dream. Not even that. And that reminds me of a story, actually, about Lama Zopa, who's the head of the FPMT. And some years ago when I was studying the students, we have Roger, who's the attendant of Lama Zopa. He wanted to sort of give us a better feel for who really Lama Zopa was. So he gave us a talk. And in his talk, he said, you know, one time, because often when Lama Zopa does retreat, Roger's helping him out, he's the attendant. And one time he said, Rinpoche was doing a retreat, I'm not sure for how long, but often when he goes into retreat, he's completely silent, so he doesn't say anything. So Roger just sort of, you know, gives him food and doesn't talk because he's in retreat. But then he said one time he was in retreat, and it was after about, I think he said about a week or 10 days, suddenly Rinpoche said something to him, and he was like, oh. And he said to Roger, I have to start the retreat again. And Roger said, why? And he said, because I had a non-virtuous thought.
Non-virtuous?
Thought. This was after a week. And I can imagine the non-virtuous thought probably wasn't very much.
But here it is felt that no matter what kind of thought it is, you just observe.
Sorry? Sure, sure. But of course,
of course, non-virtuous thought, if we can't observe them, lead to things, you know. So what we're saying is that someone at that level would never have a non-virtuous thought. Their mind is so purified that that would never even arise. And yes, at our level, when our non-virtuous thoughts arise, don't act on them. So best, if we can, is just observe them arise and pass, if we can manage that. If we can't manage to do that, at least restrain ourselves from acting on them, you know, so we do the best we can. Okay. Any more questions about that? Yeah.
I have a question about patience.
Yeah, sure.
Second, both the initial text and the other one's commentary.
Yeah.
By the
Panchen Lama.
Panchen Lama itself. But sometimes it's like a non-bold text is inside the sentence of the bold text.
Yeah. So what?
Originally,
yeah. Because I translated this, and what you find is in the auto commentary, there are different types of commentary that the Tibetan masters do. Sometimes they're called what's called a word commentary, very common. And a word commentary is where they take a root text, which usually is not their own. It's maybe some Indian master's root text, which is very brief. And it's in verse form, and it's hard to understand because it's sort of poetic and very short. So what they do is they pad that out with a few extra words in between to make it into a more easy readable sentence. So that's called a word commentary, where they pad things out. And then sometimes you have what's called a meaning commentary, where they look at the root text and they don't comment on the individual words, but then they write a commentary that what that means. So there, in their commentary, often you won't see these verses or something. This commentary he did is a sort of a mixture of those, in that often you'll have the root verses in the commentary, and then when he's commenting on it, sometimes he'll write his own extra stuff, and sometimes he'll take a verse or sentence from the root text and pad it out with extra words. So then you have all the words in the root text in that sentence. And so that's what I've done here. Is sometimes when we have a whole paragraph of non-bold, it's because he's adding extra. And in the others where there's bold and non-bold, it's where he's written a sentence that pads out the root text with a little bit of extra meaning. So that's what I've done in the translation. Sure. Pali text.
There are a lot of examples when, you know, just Buddha came somewhere and maybe just gave a talk or a lecture or something to somebody.
Yep.
And they just became enlightened or something like that.
Sure.
Well, does it mean that in that place at that time where it was a kind of accumulation of super extraordinary beings, and just Buddha came and gave them kind of that pointing out instructions, and they all were ready, or he had some powers?
Both, really. I mean, of course, at the time of the Buddha, there was a lot of spirituality already. So there was already a lot of yogis and people who have high levels of concentration and so forth. But what was sort of missing, at least from the Buddhist perspective, is the wisdom side, the emptiness side. So therefore, these people who have a lot of practices and particularly high level of concentration and shamatha and way beyond that, their minds are already quite purified. And so all that's missing is the wisdom practice. And so then the Buddha can give that very simply, and then they can do that very quickly because they've got all the other bits already from their own practice that they can then just through a few words or very simple practice, they can then fit the bit that's missing and then achieve nirvana. So that's often what it's said. Any last questions?
So I will ask
Okay.
Are there any similar instructions to these, which could be attributed to the Buddha himself, like in some text, in some sutras?
Even here he's sometimes quoting the Buddha. So any of these quotes that said the sutra, this and this sutra, is from the Buddha. The Perfection of Wisdom Sutra he quoted a number of times, King of Concentration Sutra, this is all from the Buddha.
The first name was in that lineage was Tilopa, and it seems...
Oh, no, it goes...
Tilopa and, from the Buddha himself.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of these lineages, I think they trace them somehow back to historical Buddha. So I just mentioned Tilopa and Naropa because they're very prominent just before it came to Tibet. But there are also, I think also Tilopa is said, because here, according to Tantra, the historical Buddha also manifested in a pure form to teach Tantra. And it said, I think that Tilopa received instructions from that, from this pure form of Buddha. I think that's what my memory, something like that, Vajradhara, I think. So that's sort of the sort of lineage. It's not like somehow Tilopa invented it himself. No, but what I've heard a couple of times when I've been to his teachings is that, we talk about the two wings of wisdom, compassion, or emptiness and bodhicitta. And on the surface, it seems like bodhicitta, maybe not that difficult. Emptiness, oof, too difficult. And so His Holiness often says that he thought that would be the case. But when he went to practice them, what he found was he had some experience of emptiness, but the bodhicitta was very difficult, he said. So he sort of, in that story, he sort of indicated that he had some sort of realization of emptiness, and that actually that was easier than the bodhicitta for him.
And yet, it's in the account of Kandura, who says that the first time that she saw His Holiness sitting in the car, with all these arms around him. The first time that I read it, it was like, okay, so someone was holding his arm around him. And then I read it again, maybe a year or two later, and it's like, bang!
Yes.
So, he saw 1,000 arms in Genovese.
Interesting. Okay. So we've finished this session. So in the last session, we've only got a little bit to go, but... there is a couple of things there that I want to mention that hopefully will clear up a few things. So we'll finish that in the next session. So let's take a tea break and come back at 5 o'clock.